Here's the story of some lovely ladies who were podcasting as very lovely girls. All of them like to debrief. Debrief society. All of them like shoes.
Here's the story of a quarrel of infants who were podcasting a podcast of their own. They debriefed their manly briefs and scratched their man bars because they were all wrong.
Till the one day when these ladies met these fellows, and they knew that it was much more than a tone. The times they subjugated their own voice and power and authority, and that's the way we got infants debriefing on thrones. Infants debriefing on thrones. Infants debriefing on thrones. That's the way they recorded the listener essay on authority for the Debrief Society and Infants on Thrones.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Quorum.
Listener essay.
Hello, this is Stephanie Hawking, Stephen's lesser-known twin sister, and one of today's token female voices on Infants on Thrones. Because today Infants Tom and Bob interview two people of the female persuasion, Chelsea and Jamie, who are on a podcast of the female persuasion called The Debrief Society. Maybe they will invite me on someday to their podcast. So listen in as Tom and Bob awkwardly flirt with Chelsea and Jamie, and then as they less awkwardly discuss Chelsea's excellent listener essay on authority. Take it away, big boys.
No, you don't.
Performance time, yeah.
Okay. Or we just kind of fade in this kind of bullcrap chatter here, and then it's like, oh yeah, okay, so I guess it's on. All right, or so we're on the air. All right.
So why don't you guys do video? I'm just curious.
We actually have been doing video the last two or three times. I was telling Chelsea this because I got a new webcam, and we did a recording last night. Bob and Glenn and John and Matt, right? We did the follow-up to the Lowry letters. And I, for whatever reason, I didn't change the preferences on my mic input. And nobody freaking told me. And so now I sound like I'm, you know, all the way in the back of the room and it's all echoey and all that crap. And everybody seemed to be just fine with it. So nobody told me.
Sounded good at the time. I don't know.
Did I sound all right? Because when I listen back, I'm like, what the hell's wrong with my mic?
Oh.
That doesn't sound... Whatever, dude. Yeah, but now, like I was telling Chelsea, but now we have video, so now we kind of we get a little distracted easier. At least I do.
Well, and I guess we should
say. You were saying they try to flash each other.
Did you say that, Tom?
Well, I told Chelsea about the one time Randy stood up and he started.
Oh gosh, Randy! He always has a reason to just like whip something out. I don't know what the deal is with him.
Well, where's he? I feel Jip. Come on.
Yeah, none of that with the rest of us, but you need Randy on for that extra show.
Well, and then the one time that we got video bombed by Matt's wife, Kristen, she came in.
Oh, jeez.
So
do you guys...
I don't know what I think about video. I kind of like it, but then I kind of hate it because it...
I'm the same.
Because now I can flip off Glenn, and the listeners don't get to know. So I guess that's.
But does Glenn?
Well, and you guys are a bigger group too. Like I think the more people you have, the harder it probably is on video because if you're not talking, you're like watching everybody else, and I don't know.
Right.
I could. See that
and we kind of make fun of each other. You guys keep it respectful and loving, I mean, we're kind of. I don't know. We're constantly doing the locker room humor, except for Bob. He's keeping it above board for us.
I try to keep you guys in line, but, you know.
That's what's so great about you guys, though, is you can tell your friends, you know, like the jabs at each other, and it's just laid back.
We should try that, Chelsea. We should see how the others handle that.
We need to be mean. We need to be mean to
try. Let's just.
I don't know if that's what you guys should
it
do.
It just but... depends on the time of month, really. I mean, exactly. Are they going to laugh with us, or are they going to start crying?
Or,
and end in tears.
One way or the other. So when you guys do video, do you actually release it to your audience that way as well? Or do you only do video for your own benefit? Okay.
No, it's usually we all usually, it's more to keep track that Jenny only has one glass of wine. Cause it really, if we see her pouring another, we kind of know that her voice is going to slow down and we kind of know where that's headed. So we're really just kind of babysitting Jenny there.
Love it.
Is that the second glass? Okay, we better start wrapping this up.
Yes, we know that. We know that's that.
Awesome. All right. So,
how about we start with this? We've done, Bob and I have done this in the past, and I think it's kind of fun where we do like a preference checklist.
Okay.
Where I'll ask you two binary things. Maybe there'll be the occasional third, and Jamie and Chelsea, you guys have to give an answer and try to not think too hard about it because. These essentially define who you are, right? Okay. This is how Bob and myself are going to judge you from here on out.
Yeah.
Is how you answer these questions.
Oh, yikes.
Are you going to, Tom, are you going to genderify these or what? Are you still going to do like Metallica versus AC/DC and just like.
That was one of them. Spoiler alert. No.
I was just wondering if you're going to do like My Little Pony versus Barbie or.
Oh my gosh. No.
I'm a Metallica fan.
No, that's
are you
cool.
Really?
I love Metallica. Yes.
So you got Tom Cred points right
there.
There
we go. Already
on the team.
All right. I threw some Mormon ones together because I don't think we've done very many Mormon ones in the past. So I'll kind of go down the list fairly quickly. We can cut some of this out and post if it gets too pedantic or whatever. Okay. So Jamie, you're first and then Chelsea.
All right.
Okay. Joseph Smith or Brigham Young?
Joseph Smith.
Definitely Joseph Smith.
Joseph Smith. Okay. Gordon B. Hinckley or Thomas Monson?
Hinckley.
Hinckley.
Oh yeah, that's an easy one. Jeez.
Really?
I feel like Monson? That should be like a bell. You guys, I wish you
could. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll add a bell.
I just hit the carpet twice, like as if I'm gonna like I get it.
Okay. John DeLynn or Kate Kelly?
Oh my gosh. John. I'm gonna have to go with John just I love both, but I'm just...
I love both, too.
Tom, you're getting us in trouble. What kind of dumb question is that?
These are not dumb. These are... Like I said, there's an area of judgment that's going to... No,
you're kidding. Right.
No,
you're
these
right,
are just for fun. These are just for fun.
I have to go with John. What about you, Chels?
I would go with Kate, because I love them both, too, but I know Kate a little bit better.
And I know John a little bit better, so that's perfect.
There you go.
All right. Okay, now this one... There's three answers here. Coffee, tea, or alcohol?
Oh, alcohol.
Coffee.
Yeah. Mitt Romney or John Huntsman Jr.?
Oh, nice.
Oh, geez.
Come on.
I'll go with Huntsman.
Yep, Huntsman.
You have chosen
the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
Primary or nursery?
Primary.
Nursery.
Mm.
Hmm.
Nursery was the best calling I've ever had.
You don't have to prepare anything.
You'll have to explain that.
Because you don't have to teach anything. It's the perfect calling if you're in a faith crisis. Because you get all this cred from the ward because they're like, oh, you're in nursery. Because nobody wants to do nursery, right? You're like, if you just show up and take care of their kids, everybody's grateful. But you don't have to teach anything, and you don't have to listen to what's being said in gospel doctrine that drives you crazy, and it's great.
I gotta tell you, I lived in Japan for almost 4 years, and they put me in nursery because I didn't know the language. So they thought, hey, let's just stick her in nursery.
Oh, yeah.
Little kids don't care. Well, the little kids, I thought they were like, they'd always run up to me and give me hugs and point at me and say things. And I thought I was like their best friend. And then like 2-3 years into it, my husband's like, oh, do you know what they're calling you? I had no idea. They were calling me like butt face and all this stuff. And I just would like,
are you serious?
Nursery kids? Like, yeah.
Butt face. Yes. Wow.
Isn't that awesome? So I, ever since then, I like glare at the nursery room when I walk past.
That's horrible. Evil.
You little demons. I know what you're up to. Okay, moving away from Mormon stuff. Fiction or nonfiction?
I'm fiction.
Fiction.
Apple or Android?
Windows Phone?
That's not an option.
I have the Apple, but I'm switching over to an Android, so I'm
on the fence there.
I'm Apple, but I'm ashamed about it.
You're ashamed?
Yeah, I'm very ashamed.
Wow. That's the first I've heard from an Apple fan to be like, I guess I'm okay with Apple.
No, I know. I'm a minion. My husband's always like, Steve Jobs got you. He just got you.
Part of the Borg. Yeah.
But between Mac and Windows, that's an easy. That's a Mac. That's easy.
Yeah. Okay. Drive through or dine in?
Dine in.
Dine in.
Music or podcasts?
Music. Even though I love podcasts.
Oh. I want to say music because I love music, but what I actually listen to more is podcasts. I'm kind of a podcast junkie.
Nice. I like it. Jimmy Fallon or Jimmy Kimmel?
Fallon.
Fallon.
Really? I'm actually a Kimmel guy, for the record.
Well, they have you, so.
Yeah, I know.
Wait your turn, Tom.
I know. I'm the one throwing the questions. Star Trek, Star Wars?
Star Wars.
Star Wars.
Marvel, DC?
What?
That says it all. That's perfect. Just leave it.
Okay. Moving on.
What?
Heavy metal or country?
Ew, heavy metal.
Heavy metal.
Chelsea hesitated and she's like, after the ew.
No. They're like almost equally bad, but country is just a little bit worse for me.
I love you, Chelsea. Love it.
That's hilarious. The Killers or Imagine Dragons?
Killers. Oh, sorry, Jamie. I jumped
No, go ahead.
Killers.
Ooh. Imagine Dragons.
Okay, I got to hear Bob on that one.
The Killers. Imagine Dragons. They're too young, too early. They got some one-hit wonder.
Just answer the question.
Yeah, just describe it.
You don't need to explain it with your four-star scenario. All right. And then this is the one that's kind of the nod to Bob, and I think I've asked this in all of them. Muse or Nine Inch Nails?
Muse.
Yes!
Fail! All right, the call is over. I can't believe it.
The new album just dropped yesterday. Eh?
It's good. Yeah, it's not too bad. It's not great. It's not too bad.
It's good stuff. I like it.
All right.
I doubt Chelsea and I have listened to it.
I haven't.
It's not quite as good as some of the earlier ones, but it's good. It's good. Huh. Trying to keep my answers short for you, Tom.
Thanks, man. By the way, it's not just for me. It might be for the listeners too. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
Good. Anyway. Okay, so let's do a real quick Debrief Society podcast introduction. So Jamie, Chelsea, you guys are with this podcast called the Debrief Society. Tell us just a little bit about it and how long you've been doing it and how you guys are going to essentially take our throne away from us.
Never. We can never, ever do that. We wouldn't want to, but someday, again, we will challenge you guys to a SmackDown. And hopefully everyone will get to look forward to that. But I think we're in our fourth month of actually posting. We're posting about once a week to our podcast and once or twice a week to our blog. So we have some guest writers and other things, but we did, it kind of came through with a group of women who were big fans of Mormon stories and infants and lots of other things, but really we're kind of feeling like, hey, there's a lot of women that maybe aren't voicing some of their thoughts, but maybe they would if they were maybe just with other women. Maybe that they'd feel a little bit safer in doing that. And plus, women's experience in the church and leaving the church is different. And so we, I guess they just kind of, they saw a need and got together and started it. And then, I don't know if you guys dealt with this, but there was kind of just a lot of people kind of, we started with a really big group, a lot of interest, a lot of people wanting to start. They were just, We were all strangers from like all over the globe, really. And now we're down to 12 of us. So there's 12 of us and we're kind of the regulars and the ones that are going to stay for the long run. So Debrief Society is basically, it's a safe environment. We're trying to give women a platform to just speak their voice about their journey, try to get some, you know, for once, have their questions, their thoughts, their concerns validated instead of, you know, swept aside and, you know, instead of a little pat on the head, we're trying to validate their feelings and all those things. Anyway, we have several different platforms to do that on. So we have one-on-one interviews for women that want kind of the intimate interview. We have panel discussions. We do listener essays, which are really fun. I just recorded mine the night before last. And that was an experience. We have an enrichment committee who puts out just amazing work on all kinds of things about transitioning back into like a real world. You know, if you've grown up in that bubble, how do we transition as women to living in a real world? We're just trying to do this in a healthy way. And we all kind of got together and just thought, man, when we were going through this transition, it was so lonely for us. Even if we had husbands or people go through it with us, it was just a lonely experience leaving the church. And, you know, most of us did lose friends. Some people lost family members. And so really it was, we kind of thought, man, what would we have wanted? And we're trying to fill that gap.
Makes sense.
So you both have left the church and most of the people that are involved with the podcast are former Mormons?
They are. So we're all former. Some people have actually removed their names and then some people haven't.
Right.
Wow. Cool. So Tom has a long history with the word safe. I just want to double click on that because when I hear safe, it's a really interesting, like relative to what I think I can infer, but if I can be not so safe to talk about what safe means, is it not just, relative to leaving the church, but just the fact that most of the Mormon podcasts out there are dominated by, I guess, the male voice and women feel intimidated to come on or participate because they don't feel like it's as inviting. Is that what you mean or something else?
I think so. I think that, I don't personally, I actually would love to have some guys on our thing, but you know, it's called Debrief Society. So I don't know. I don't know. What do you think, Chels?
Yeah, I would love to have some guys on too. I think that'd be fun. Like, I don't think you can talk about leaving Mormonism in a way that's perceived as safe for anybody who listens to it. But yeah, I think we just wanted to kind of provide a sense of community and where women could hear other women talking about the same things they're going through. Because like Jamie said, our experience can be a little different sometimes than what the men go through.
Totally.
Yeah, and I totally echo that. I mean, I think it's great that, you know, you guys are focusing more on the women's side of things because you're right. You know, women do experience things much different, especially when it comes to leaving the church. I mean, we had a discussion just the other night. I don't remember if it's going to be aired or not. I can't remember if it's post or after. But we talked about how some women, they view the whole experience differently because – John Hamer was talking to me about, you know, oh, it was the top three thing. That's what it was. Mm. And he had mentioned that sexism was like, I hope this doesn't come out before that. All right. He talked his number one, spoiler alert, his number one issue was sexism. And it was surprising because none of us were like, why didn't we put sexism in our top three issues? And he talked about how he and a few friends went into a Mormon congregation and kind of did the incognito, you know, double agent kind of thing by just trying to observe the experience. And he's like, sexism was everywhere. It was just so blatant. It was just in everything from it, you know, just from the meeting to the structure to the lessons, just everything. He's like, it was so obvious that it was just, it was like, how do these people not see how bad this is? How the inequality is just so heightened.
Yeah.
And the rest of us on the panel are like, yeah, okay, so can I revise my list now? And I mentioned the story that the first time I actually experienced, because obviously I've got my bias, my privilege and whatever. And when I was escorting my wife through the veil when we were getting married, she gets into the slush room. She's like, so who let you in to the veil? Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, Jesus did. And she's like, oh, so Jesus didn't let me in?
Aww.
And then she's like, why did I have to have a veil over my face?
Yeah.
And my answer was like, because you're more pure.
Like, that's gotta be it.
Yeah.
It's actually horrible. And then she actually asked me too, like, so you get to know my secret name, but I don't get to know yours.
Yeah.
And it was like the first time while I was like, you know, totally in my believing stages, I was like, you know, this is actually not fair. That's kind of a crappy deal right there.
That part made me so mad.
Sorry, Chelsea, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that part that my husband got to know my name, but I didn't get to know his, that made me so angry. And I was getting ready to go on my mission the first time I went through. So obviously in a very believing place. But yeah, when I found that out, I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't really. Yeah, I mean, there's no basis for it other than, well, men came up with the system, it seems. I mean,
right.
I don't.
Right.
Yeah, so let's make it great for us and forget about the rest.
Right.
Ugh, it's awful.
Right. Well, and we try to put this veneer of equality on things now, but when you learn about the history of the doctrine and the history of the temple, it's never been equal, you know, and they just took it for granted. Back then, you know, it was, well, yes, of course, women are subservient to men, but now we try to make it seem like we're equal, and that creates some confusion because, yeah, it's not. It's not equal at all. It's the sexism is built in to everything.
Yeah. I always wish the guys could sit in on those Relief Society lessons where we are trying so hard to do mental gymnastics to make that work, because we're all sitting there uncomfortable talking about it. You're surrounded by older women who are smiling and nodding, and you feel like you have to do that too. And you're just thinking, this is not right. Am I the only person in here so uncomfortable with this? And man, there's some just, like I said, mental gymnastics. And it makes me curious how men would, you know, how they would react, how they would feel sitting in on those lessons.
Right.
I think some of us would be oblivious, frankly, but anything to raise awareness and try to, you know, bridge the gap of inequality, I'm all for. Anyway, sorry, Bob, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just going to say, sitting in on something like that, I think from a guy's perspective, sometimes this is going to sound really naive and stupid, but we don't get enough exposure of like women having differences of opinion and like having an intelligent conversation where there's multiple perspectives. And it's like the stereotypical guy is like, what do they talk about? Do they all just like, you know, bow their heads and agree all the time? Cause they're all like one person, right? Like, or do they actually have their own opinions? That'd be crazy to see women. I'm channeling like the, you know, the Mormon dude from 10 years ago, but seriously, like if you've never sat in an environment where women can actually be themselves, which Relief Society, from what I understand, isn't that environment, but it's much closer. It's much closer to it than women mixed in with men where they can't even speak up at all, hardly. But then even by themselves, I don't know. There's just always this thing of like, I wonder how they disagree. I've never seen that, you know,
not openly.
No,
never openly. If you want to hear crickets in a Relief Society room, raise your hand and say, I don't agree with that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And everybody gets like, everybody goes pale. Like, what?
What?
What do you mean? Doesn't agree.
So
it's really awkward. Yeah.
So my stereotype wasn't too far off then.
No, it actually wasn't. It was, yeah. Sadly, I mean, looking back, that I wish I would have stuck up you know, stuck my hand up a little bit more. And, but I, as it was, I, whenever I raised my hand, I'd look around and I'd see people rolling their eyes because they were like, oh, here it comes.
Me too. Me too.
And I got so sick of that. But, you know, yeah. I just always felt like, I know I'm not the only person sitting here feeling like this or wondering this or feeling so horrible about this. And I know somebody else's heart is breaking right now. So I'm just going to say it. And there was never a time that I did that where somebody didn't come up to me afterwards and give me a hug and say, thank you, thank you, thank you. I've never been able to do that. Nice. So it just, there's such a need. It makes me feel bad. There's just a lot of women who really are afraid to raise their voices. Our goal and our hope is that they feel safe coming on to the podcast and having their voice heard. So we're, you know, just letting them know like, hey, yeah, your husband's voice has been, and your father's voice and your brother's voice and your 12-year-old boy's voice has been important forever. But yours has been too. So you need to make sure you let people know that. So, and if they don't want to come on the podcast, we give them another way and, you know, where they can just, if they're a better writer than a speaker, they can write on our blog, you know? So we're really just trying to help women get through that transition.
Nice.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And it's not all feely women emotions, blah, blah, blah. We, you know, we've struggled with this in a lot of our meetings that most of us are smart asses. We really are. And we've struggled with how much do we, in fact, I think we've, Chelsea, correct me if I'm wrong. I know you and I have been like, how much do we Infants on Thrones this? And how much do we like calm this down for, you know, the women that are maybe trying to leave or just barely starting their transition. And so we've been really trying to pinpoint the women that we're trying to help the most. So we're working on that balance because like I said, a lot of us need that outlet to just blow off some steam and be sarcastic if we need to. So,
all right, cool.
Wow, Infants on Thrones is an adjective. I would have never thought I'd see the day.
You That's are
verb cool. even.
Yeah,
verb.
We're gonna infants verb, on yeah. thrones.
That is awesome.
Okay, so let's move into Chelsea's essay titled "Authority."
I say to Israel, the Lord will never permit me or any other man who stands as president of the church to lead you astray. It is not in the program. It is not in the mind of God.
Whether by my own voice or by the voice of my servant, it is the same.
Whether by mine own voice or by the voice of mine servants, it is the same.
Whether by mine own voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same.
Whether by mine own voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same.
Whether by mine own voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same.
Whether by my own voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same.
Whether by mine own voice or by the voice of my servants, it is the same. It is the same. It is the same. It is the same.
The same.
It is the same.
The same.
In the church, raised by devout convert parents. From the earliest age I can remember, I was taught the importance of authority. Whenever I had a question, a doubt, or a decision to make, there was a clear place to go for direction. My church leaders would never lead me astray. Of course, I could receive my own revelation, but that would always be in line with what the Lord's servants taught. If not, it was not to be trusted. In many ways, that deference to authority served me well. I was a model teenager, and I stayed out of trouble. Yay, even the appearance of trouble. I remember once in high school making plans to sneak out of the house to go out with my friends after my curfew. I was so racked with guilt that I couldn't go through with it. Alcohol came nowhere near my lips. Drugs were out of the question. And despite being completely boy crazy from the age of approximately 3, I managed to not even kiss anyone until I was 17. Believe it or not, I still had a lot of fun as a teenager, and I don't regret keeping all of the rules. I think it probably saved me some difficult experiences. I went to BYU, the Lord's one true university, and despite some culture shock my first semester, I loved it. When I was 21, I decided to serve a mission and was called to France. And that is where I first began to question the whole notion of authority. So many of the things we were told to do simply did not make sense to me. It was the first time my own understanding was in conflict with what I was asked to do by my priesthood leaders. For example, we rode bikes. Even though the cities where I served all had cheap and reliable public transportation, and many of the roads were not safe for biking, we spent hours fixing flat tires, traveling to and from distant areas, and having wheels, seats, chains, and occasionally entire bikes stolen. It's a small thing, and I actually enjoyed the time outside riding through the beautiful French streets and villages. But it was obvious that we were not doing what was most effective. We were doing it just because we were told to. Another time, my companion and I were told by our district leader to stop visiting an investigator. We had been visiting with her daily in order to help her quit smoking and to read the Book of Mormon with her. We felt strongly that we needed to keep visiting her. She was interested, and finding someone in France who's interested in talking about God? Not easy. But, bless his heart, this sweet 19-year-old elder had the authority to tell us what to do. So we obeyed him. Instead of helping someone learn more about the church, we spent our time knocking on an endless line of doors in mostly empty apartment buildings and street contacting people who wanted to be left alone. It was also on my mission that it first dawned on me that maybe the church isn't the right choice for everyone. In my first area, I met a family whose teenage son was investigating the church. His mother, Celine, was from Taiwan, and she was Buddhist. She's one of those amazing people who just exudes love and charity. She cooked Chinese food for us, had us over for Christmas, and was sort of a surrogate mom for all the missionaries in the area. When I later transferred to an area 2 hours away, she heard through the grapevine that I had the flu, so she drove all the way there just to bring me vegetable soup. When we would talk to her about the Book of Mormon, she would say, "Yes, yes, it is a very good book. Joseph Smith was an inspired man. I think he was a prophet." And then she'd continue on being a Buddhist and helping people. It became clear to me that she was doing just fine with the beliefs she had. In fact, she was doing much better spiritually than a lot of Mormons I know. According to what I had been taught, I should have had something to offer her, but instead, she was teaching me. Those experiences weren't enough to make me lose all my trust in authority, but as we say as missionaries, the seeds were planted. About 8 months into my mission, I had a dream that a close friend of mine died. I knew from letters that he had been struggling for a while. I felt like I should call him. Actually, it was more than a feeling. I was desperate to talk to him. I hesitantly called and asked my mission president's wife if there were ever exceptions made to the rule about making phone calls home to friends. I explained my dream and how I was feeling. She said she would run it by the president, and later that day she got back to me and told me. The answer was no. A few weeks later, I got an early morning phone call from my dad. My friend had died. Cause of death, suicide. Eventually, to make a long story a bit shorter, I asked my mission president to release me so I could go home. I didn't believe in what I was doing anymore. I wasn't helping anyone. And obedience for obedience's sake wasn't yielding the blessings I had been taught to expect. In fact, it was causing me severe anxiety and depression. Initially, he said okay, and then he backpedaled and tried to convince me to stay. My bishop from home called me and really put the pressure on, telling me I was disappointing him, my friend who had died, the Lord, and my ancestors who went before. I'm not exaggerating, that's really what he said. But for the first time ever, I said no to a church authority. I was ready to go home. I wouldn't be convinced otherwise. 2 weeks later, I was back in the U.S., After my mission, I shelved my bad experiences, stayed active in the church, married my high school sweetheart in the temple, and graduated from BYU. And then Proposition 8 happened. My brother is gay and had recently come out to our family. I had gay friends. I saw no reason why they shouldn't be legally married and many reasons why they should. Even though I was nowhere near California, the church's actions cut me to my core. How could I feel such clarity, spiritual confirmation about something, and have it be so diametrically opposed to what my church was doing? That was the beginning of the end of my belief. It took a few more years, but eventually it all unraveled, and I was left with a pile of threads with no idea how to put them back together and make sense of my life. How could I ever make a decision and know I was doing the right thing? Who could I trust for answers? How could I be sure of anything? Shortly after my husband and I moved back to the East Coast, I got pregnant with our first child. The pregnancy was difficult, but he was born healthy at 38 weeks. I'll never forget the first night in the hospital after his birth. My husband had gone home to sleep, and I sat in my hospital bed alone, cradling my precious boy in my arms, exhausted, sore, and overwhelmed with love and responsibility for this little wrinkled human. Suddenly, out of nowhere, I felt the desire to give him a blessing. And I did. I set him gently in my lap, placed my hands on his head, and started to speak to him in the way I had always heard blessings given to me and others. "Sawyer," I said, "having authority." I didn't know what to say next. Did I have authority? And then the words came to me, "As your mother, I bless you." I didn't need permission from someone in a line of priesthood holders. I didn't need anyone else to witness the moment and tell me it was okay to give it an official stamp of approval. The authority was me. I was enough. Since then, I've come to see obedience to authority as less of a virtue than I used to. It's easier to just obey. It's easy if the thinking has been done. It is much harder, much more complicated, to figure out for myself what is the right choice. What is most ethical? What will be the best for me, my family, and those around me? Sometimes I get it wrong. A lot of times I get it wrong. There are no guarantees. But I think that's how it's supposed to be. Not knowing, not being absolutely sure. And I kind of, sort of think, maybe this is what it means to be human. I am my own authority. How terrifying and how wonderful.
Every day when I open my eyes, now it feels like a Saturday. Yeah. Taking down from the shelf all the parts of myself that are packed away. Yeah. It's love with the joy in my heart. Is it God by another name? Who's to say how it goes? All I know is I'm back in the world again. Back in the world again. It's the only way to be.
The only way to be. And I remember when first submitted this to us, Chelsea, and it was a while ago because we're a bunch of slackers over here. and that's one of the reasons why you got involved with the Debris Society podcast. And as soon as you'd mentioned, like, hey, can I take it to these guys? I was like, wait, no, that was one of the best essays we've got. Wait. And
awesome.
And I was like, can we maybe work together? And luckily, and I'm really grateful that you guys were willing to do this because it's a really, really powerful essay, and I'm not just washing your proverbial balls on this because I think that doesn't work in this environment. And I just
realized, yeah, you had to like catch yourself. I'm just not washing your proverbial.
Nope, never mind.
Just your proverbial. You can just stop there.
No, but it's actually really powerful, and it was it actually got me choked up, and I shared it with my wife, and I shared it with my oldest daughter. And I said, you know, this is the kind of thing, this message that you're delivering in your essay, I think more people need to hear this than anybody that I know. It's just a really, really powerful and touching message. So I just wanted to say that as kind of a preface. So.
Oh, well, thanks so much. It was a really kind of interesting experience writing it. I kind of started out wanting to do something totally different than what came out. And yeah, it was interesting to get those thoughts, you know, all put together.
And you covered a lot of ground. It was amazing how much was contained in just 10 minutes. Like, it was over before it started. For me, I was like, what, it's over? Oh, I want more. Like, it was good. It was like, you didn't know how long it was, like, really breezy, but just covered so much ground. So I really like that. 'Cause you didn't focus, even though it was called Authority, you didn't like focus on one story with lots of details. You focused on like a smattering of it, of the concept of authority just popping up over and over and over again in your life. And I like that.
Yeah, you know, it's just kind of one of those themes that I've identified as, you know, as I've left the church, that I think all of us, our perspective just changes in so many different ways. But that's probably the number one kind of worldview shift that's really affected me the most, was that shift from being under someone else's authority to realizing that I'm my own authority. That's been huge. You know, there's so many little changes that feel huge when you leave the church, like drinking coffee for the first time, or, you know, taking off your garments. Those are really surface things that feel huge because they're so, I don't know, culturally significant. They say a lot about where you are, but they don't really change your worldview. And so, you know, I think that kind of more internal shift has just really affected me a lot. And I think it was good for me to identify that in the essay and, kind of looking forward, like, okay, what now?
And one of the things in your essay that I'm sure was intentional, or maybe not, I don't know, was that key moment. It's like you, in the art of storytelling, you brought us in and you showed us when you finally stood up for yourself and told the church leader or your mission president or whoever it was, no. Because to me, that was like that defining moment. It was almost like that's where the real Chelsea stood up and your identity shifted. Because I still remember the first time, I mean, because I was one of those people who would always say yes to every single calling, no matter what. And I would just, you know, bear it, grit my teeth, and just do it. Like, okay, they're essentially acting for the Lord. They prayed. They're better than me. Who am I to challenge this? I'll just grin and bear it and take it. And then I still remember the first time I said, no, I can't do that. And I felt guilty as hell for a while until, you know, I started to realize, you know, I need to do what's right for me. Anyway, that to me was a really cool moment in your essay.
Yeah, I mean, we're taught that it's selfish, right? To think about what do I want to do? What's good for me? You know, we're supposed to just submit to that revelation that comes from above, you know, to our leaders, and to even consider what do I think about this is, yeah, it's considered selfish. And
not just that, Chelsea, but it's also like, if you don't obey, you're going to be lacking those blessings you would have gotten for obeying.
Yeah.
And that's such a form of spiritual abuse that I just saw over and over. And even throughout your essay, when your home bishop called you and he was guilting you into staying on your mission, I thought, what an extreme case of spiritual abuse. That is absolute. One of the questions I had, I didn't go on a mission, and so I was trying to like put myself in that situation. And I was thinking like, man, if you could go back to that phone call, like knowing what you know now, would you say anything different?
Oh, that's a really good question. So another layer to that part of the story that I didn't get into in the essay, because I didn't want it to get too convoluted and complex. That bishop was actually the father of my friend who had died.
Oh my gosh.
No way. There's a twist.
Wow.
So, and I had been engaged to this guy before my mission.
The one that killed himself?
Who died.
Chelsea.
Yeah, and we had broken up, but we were still good friends. And so this was his dad. So this was the guy who was going to be my father-in-law, who I was still very close to. And he was obviously going through you know, probably the worst time in his life. I think it's probably safe to say. So that added a kind of another layer of emotion onto that, you know, like, wow. And, but yeah, he really felt like me going home was a horrible mistake and I shouldn't do it. And I knew he was wrong.
And you had a chance to talk to him, right? This was on the phone?
Yes. So my mission president let him call me.
Right. So there's no irony there.
My mission president was trying to convince me to stay also.
Right.
He said he had never had anyone ask to go home before.
Not on his watch.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just so bizarre because, well, it's not bizarre. It's just, it's more tragic than anything. So I don't mean to overanalyze it, but the fact that you threatening to leave your mission triggered a simple phone call, but you having a concern for a friend was like, nope, that the answer is no.
Yes.
And it's like the difference of, I don't know, if you only knew, if you were only, you know, cynical enough at that time in your life, which it doesn't sound like you were, and I wasn't either as a missionary, to know to play the system, like, oh, you just say these things and all of a sudden they freak out and you know, you could have gotten a phone call earlier, but you were just asking because that's the thing you do. You defer to authority and
trying to keep the rules and trying to do what you're supposed to do. Yeah.
Wow. You know, I was also going to ask, because there's still this residual leftover Mormon thing inside of me where I always just judge people or assume things or wonder how it was for them. When you eventually did go home early, part of me wants to know, like, how early and how you just sort of skipped over the next phase of your life. But you said you kind of moved on. But, like, that's a huge, massive deal because you essentially returned without honor. Like, you didn't serve your mission by some standards, which I don't believe that now. But back at a certain point in my life, you know, going home early is like, well, you failed. Don't even talk about that part of your life, which.
Huge failure. Yeah.
So how did you overcome that?
The only way to see it.
How did you, like, compartmentalize it?
So my parents actually moved while I was on my mission. So I left on my mission from Virginia and went home to Utah. In fact, they moved into their house like 2 days before I came home. And so that actually helped a little bit because nobody in their ward knew me. Nobody knew how long I had been out. So I didn't have to face a lot of questions right away. Mm-hmm. And I think people tend to be a little nicer about that to sister missionaries than to elders.
Good point.
Because for the elders, you know, for guys, it's like, you have to go on a mission, you know, it's not optional.
Right.
Whereas for the women, it's a little more, oh, you can choose to go. And that's a nice thing if you go.
Yeah. And you could just not talk about it. And then people wouldn't assume one way or the other. It's like, it doesn't.
Oh yeah.
It's not
people
like a check mark.
People don't just assume you've gone on a mission.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's not like a prerequisite to being a good eligible man. For a woman, it's like, oh, whether or not you went, you don't even have to bring it up. Okay.
Right. So I was out for 9 months. So I did half a mission. Mm-hmm. So the people that had the hardest time with it were my parents. They really, especially my dad, he is really, really into missions, and he joined the church when he was 17 and so went on his mission in, you know, less than 2 years after being baptized. And that was just such a solidifying event in his life, I think, that he just worships the missionary program. It's just the greatest thing ever. So me going on a mission, I was his first kid to go. It was a huge deal. He wrote me every single day that I was out.
Wow.
He wrote a letter and put it in the mail every day. So he was just so excited for me and so supportive. So for me to come home early really, really hurt for him. So that was probably, you know, that transition back into not being a missionary anymore was kind of the hardest part, because for a while he wanted me to go back. And so he, you know, he kept trying to convince me to go back and, didn't want to hear that I wasn't interested in going back.
So how did you reconcile not going back, but still staying active and just moving on and being like, well, I'm still a good faithful Mormon, but going back isn't the only option for me.
Right. I still believed in the church. I had more doubts than I had had before for sure, but I was able to kind of compartmentalize those. And I went right back to BYU, like a couple months after I got back, started winter semester. And just had some therapy and went right back into what I had been doing before.
So. Oh my gosh. So many interesting things. So now I want to like annoy you and ask you about having therapy, because that also has a stigma with it. Like, it's no big deal nowadays, you know,
right?
Outside of the church, who cares? Whatever. Therapy's fine. But like, as a believing Mormon, it's like, and she went to therapy. Did you hear?
Right.
So how did that go down? How did that make you feel?
So I don't know if this is still the case, but when I came home, which was in 2000, the church had a program where all returning missionaries were supposed to see a psychiatrist.
Oh, wow. Oh. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I came home in 2000. I missed out.
Well, you didn't come home early. So,
oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Only if you went home early for like mental health reasons.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Which is what they billed it as, I guess.
What? they like stamped it as their like mental health problem.
No, I don't know. But you know how you get like a medical release?
Yeah.
Quote,
yeah.
Quote. You know, that's, I went home on a medical release. I wasn't sick, but you know,
they have to have an excuse and it can't be doubt. That's
no,
there's no line right. item for that. So,
right. Doubt is a sickness, I guess. So, okay. Yeah. So I saw a church psychiatrist who was wonderful. Actually, he was great. His name is Richard Ferry, and he actually, published in Sunstone a couple times.
Oh,
About missionary, he specialized in missionaries who come home early. So saw him, and then he referred me to a local counselor in the Provo area who I saw for a couple months. But it was really helpful. It helped me a lot making that transition. And I kind of think all missionaries coming home should have therapy.
Yeah, I think so too. Actually,
it's not easy to go back to normal life after the mission experience, even if it was a really good one. I think it's hard for a lot of people. So
can I ask how you were emotionally and mentally through all that? I mean, you were obviously dealing with your friend, and that was devastating all by itself.
Yeah.
And then you ejecting yourself from the system where there's a lot of demands and expectations on you. I mean, were there, as much as you want to, go ahead.
It was the hardest time I've ever been through, without a doubt. It was so hard because I already was struggling as a missionary before I got this news. And then I stayed for a month after finding out that he had died. And so, yeah, it was, I felt like I was a zombie. Like, I don't even have really clear memories of what I was doing. And because it was a lot to process and to deal with.
Were your parents, were people under the impression, like, or even yourself, like, do you feel like you went home because you were grieving or because you had doubts? Both?
Yeah, both.
It was both. Okay.
Both. Yeah, you know, and I've wondered, would I have stayed the whole time had this tragedy not happened? And I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I might have been able to just, you know, fake it and keep going.
Yeah.
You know, do my time like a lot of people do.
Well, you essentially did that after the mission, right? Because you said you shelved your bad experiences and you stayed active and you got married in the temple. So talk about that. How did that transition from struggling and I guess getting some sense of release or relief by coming home, but then, I mean, it didn't 100% get resolved. You sort of had to, at least part of it, put on a shelf somewhere and then revisit it later, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And my parents are kind of Sunstone Mormons.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, nice. I always kind of saw myself as a little bit, I don't know, a little bit unorthodox, and that was okay. So I think that's how I was able to keep going for so long, even with those doubts that I just, you know, just had them. And but I still loved the church. I still loved the gospel. I still felt I had a testimony. I had a witness that it was true. And you know, my family and all my friends are in the church, and it helped me in so many ways to be a member of the church. I just loved it. So yeah.
Makes sense. I mean, if anything, being in that kind of environment is as good as it gets. I mean, that's where you last the long, at least this is my opinion, where you can last the longest is when you're surrounded by Sunstone Mormons who are, you know, for the most part, relatively speaking anyway, pretty open and understanding and willing to let you have doubts to a certain degree. And so that probably contributed to a slow burn out. I don't know what year or how old you were when you eventually came out, but I'm sure it wasn't as dramatic as some other people who kind of pull the plug from a more conservative household.
No, slow burn is definitely the way to describe it. It was very slow. I still went to church through 2012.
Oh, okay.
That's when I stopped going. So.
Wow.
So let's talk a little bit about the experience you talked about when you had your child. Because to me, that was like that moment in the essay where I dare you to not get choked up. Because it's really, really cool the way you describe you have your child and then you're just overcome like, I'm going to give my child a blessing. And then you recreate where you start to do it and then you're like, the system told me to say this. This is what I've heard. And then you kind of organically change it into something else, which I thought was incredibly amazing. Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, well, that was just one of those, you know, defining moments when I look back that, you know, that I can pinpoint of my perspective shifting and shifting away from the church and away from orthodoxy. I guess I always had it in my brain about giving blessings. I found a copy, my parents had a copy of Carolyn Pearson's book of poetry called Beginnings. They had a first edition copy of it. And I found it when I was probably 10 or 11 and just devoured it. I just loved it. And to this day, Carolyn Pearson is still one of my heroes. I think she's great. And so that kind of sent me on a little bit of exploring into the history of women in the church. And I learned about how in the early church, women would give blessings. And it was a very normal thing. And it wasn't required to have the priesthood the way that we think of it today to give blessings. And I just always thought that was so cool. And I always thought, man, I want to do that. How come we're not allowed to do that? So that, you know, that seed had been planted for a long time. And then in that moment, it was what felt right. And, you know, my perspective on it has changed now because I don't necessarily believe in blessings anymore now. I don't really believe in, you know, that the priesthood is a real power or anything like that. But it was really just more about this love I had for my new baby that I had wanted so much. And to be able to express that in a way that was, kind of a ritual that, I had grown up with that expressed faith and love, to him. And yeah. And I, you know, I had never told anybody about that, before writing this essay, because it was so personal. And of course, when I was still in the church, that's not the kind of thing you know, talk about. Oh yeah, by the way, I gave my kid a blessing. That's, you know, that would definitely raise my eyebrows.
You didn't raise your hand in Relief Society? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no. Did you tell your husband?
I did. I did. Okay. But he was the only person I had told. So.
And he thought that was a great thing or uncomfortable or.
I think he thought it was a little weird.
Yeah.
Like any good man would. Come on. I mean.
Right. Like what?
What? But you're a woman. You don't have priesthood. What?
Oh, that makes me sick to hear.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm channeling again. You know, it's not who I am today, just for the record, people. Yeah.
I was just thinking that because I played that, like I mentioned earlier, I played this essay for my wife, and I said, isn't that amazing? Because who in the world has more authority over the child than the mother? I mean, she raised that child, gave birth to that child, is either breastfeeding that child and taking care of that child. Who has more authority over that child than the mother? And in a lot of ways, it's like, because I gave my son a blessing when he was struggling, because we almost lost him when he was born with a prolapsed umbilical cord. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it kind of, I take your experience and then I kind of push it onto my experience. I'm like, what gave me the right to, like, you know, put my hands on my son and quote, bless him to get better. And my wife's over there struggling for her life at the same time. And I'm just like, man, it's just so weird.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's why I just love that moment, because it's like, to me, that embraces the humanity, I don't know. It's just, I know I'm kind of gloating about it, but I loved it.
Oh, well, I'm so glad. Thank you. Yeah. And you know, for me, it's kind of a sad moment for me to think about now, because the fact that I felt like I had to not tell anyone about it, you know, the fact that I was like, oh, I have to do this when it's just me and nobody can hear me. And that's kind of sad to me now, because like, oh.
Yeah.
But I'm actually very, very grateful that you were willing to share it, because it is a personal thing. But you're absolutely right. We as people should celebrate those kinds of things, you know, like, look what Chelsea did, and you can try this too. Yeah. And it might be meaningful, and it might create a bond, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely did. Yeah.
You know, one thing I noticed from your essay is this through line of, you know, having all these stories where you're talking about authority, but not in the way that I would have projected myself talking about it when I first heard that the essay was about authority. And what I mean is, I, of course, struggled with authority in the church as well. But like, whenever somebody told me to do something, or, you know, your priesthood leader says so, there was always this subconscious like, all right, that makes sense. I mean, if I were in his shoes, or when I'm a bishop, or like, there's this like weird thing where you just assume like, oh, well, he's in that role, and I respect that because I've been in roles like that, or I will be in roles like that. And you don't have that, right? Like, when you get told something, and you just, it is the way it is because of the priesthood, you don't have anything to fall back on. Like, and then when I get to do that, I'll be challenged, and I can have some empathy, because I can have some empathy now because I'll be in the same position. So I don't know, maybe that's just an insight for me, but leaving the church, you were gaining this whole other level of authority that like I never had to consider, because I already had it. So
interesting. Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true. As women in the church, we're subservient eternally. Right. You know, to our husbands, to our priesthood leaders. And yeah, like you said, well, it's not something we ever can aspire to. Even the Relief Society president, who's, you know, the highest calling in award,
right,
is under the jurisdiction of the bishop and has to get permission to have an activity at the church, you know, on a Tuesday. And I think while we're in it, we don't even really see it. I don't think I did. I think I just kind of took it for granted sometimes that that's how things were. But looking at it from the outside now, it's awful. It's like, wow, I can't believe I put up with that for so long.
Yeah. It's crazy.
So can you kind of give us a synopsis, or kind of a short version of how you eventually just left the church or stopped believing, and where your husband was? I mean, where were you on the belief scale when, like, the experience with your son happened?
That's a good question. Let me think. I was still pretty believing at that point.
Yeah.
Still definitely still believed in God, definitely still felt like I had a testimony of the church, but just had doubts.
Sunstony.
Ever-present doubts. Sunstony. Yeah, exactly. So, like, I think I said in the essay that Proposition 8 was a big deal for me, because it coincided with my brother coming out to our family as gay. And I'm pretty politically liberal, and of course that, you know, doesn't go over well at church ever, but that was the first time that it was like the leadership, like the high leadership of the church, politically was the exact opposite of how I felt. So that was hard. And then right around that time I read Rough Stone Rolling and, was really fascinated by it. Actually, at first I felt like it was deepening my faith, like, oh, this, like, Joseph Smith had so many cool things about him I didn't know. But I wanted to hear more, and I was looking around for more, and that's how I found Mormon Stories, which was still fairly new at the time, I think. And so I started listening to that. Richard Bushman was the first one I listened to because of Rough Stone Rolling, and then started listening to more and more and more, and that it just kind of spiraled into me learning a lot of things that I hadn't known before, and kind of questioning the way I had seen some of those things before. And so, yeah, it was a lot of little things that just kind of built up over time during that slow burn where eventually I just, you know, it all kind of fell apart. It wasn't all at once. It was a little at a time. And finally, I completely lost my faith right around, I think it was like 2010, probably. But I was a young women leader in the ward, and we loved our ward, had some really great friends, really, really cool bishop. I think he was kind of a New Order Mormon a little bit. Some of the things he said made me think that. But so, you know, very active in that ward, loved it, had no intention of not going anymore. And then we decided to move. We bought a new house and moved into our new ward. And it was at that point that I think when you feel really at home in the community at church, it's easy to overlook some of the doctrinal things and some of the cultural things you don't like. But yeah. Once we were in a ward where we didn't really know anyone and we didn't really have any friends, those things just seemed so glaring to me. 'Cause I think when the person at church says something ignorant about gay people and you know that person and you love that person in other ways, you can kind of brush it off a little bit.
Yeah,
but like when it's somebody you don't know.
The grandpa it's like, effect. It's like, oh, that's just grandpa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
He's old. That's a pass.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. You kind of give them a pass if you know that person and love them already in a different way. So, yeah, it was after we started attending that new ward that I just found it harder and harder and harder just to go to church. And it got to the point where I started having panic attacks whenever we would go to church. And I remember one time my husband and I were sitting in gospel doctrine together, and he looked over me and he's like, "Chelsea, your hands are shaking. Why are your hands shaking?" And I was just trembling because I just couldn't be there anymore. So I was like, okay, this is ridiculous. I need to take a break.
Yeah.
So that's what it started out with, was taking a break.
Right.
And actually, I remember the exact Sunday because I went to Relief Society. My youngest child had just been born. He was probably 2 or 3 months old. And I walked into Relief Society holding him, sat down, and the teacher got up and said, "I'm going to talk about a topic that's not very popular in the world today, but it needs to be addressed. And it's the topic of gay marriage." And I made eye contact with her. I stood up and I walked out, and that was it. I was done.
That's amazing. Wow. I wish mine was, as exciting as that. That's
mine
like
too.
A movie exit scene.
It
you know?
Is.
The only thing missing was like, who's coming with me?
Seriously, I should have.
Nice.
So I took my baby and I went into the mother's lounge and sat there for the rest of the time until my son and my husband were all done with their meetings and we went home. So I was done. My husband kept going for another year after I stopped going. And then he followed in my footsteps, I guess, with the faith crisis. But his was very, very quick.
Hmm.
So, yeah. And for totally different reasons than mine too.
Yeah.
Like not doctrinal or?
Yeah. So, you know, my reasons had been like problems with the history and with polygamy and, you know, those historical and doctrinal things like Book of Mormon historicity.
He was just offended, right?
First vision. He wanted a beer really bad.
Oh, and, okay.
Okay. No, just kidding. No, for him, I was listening to Mormon Stories in the car one time and he was with me and I was like, "Is it okay if I listen to this?" He said, "Yeah, sure." And it was about the psychology of religion. I don't know if you guys heard that one. They talked about kind of groupthink and why people have testimonies and how that phenomenon is across all religions, and why we get warm, fuzzy feelings, why we equate warm, fuzzy feelings with truth. And it just really got into the psychology of why we believe. And that just knocked him over, because for him, he was able to dismiss a lot of the problems because he had that spiritual witness, because he had felt like God had told him it was true. And once he could see through that, that, oh, well, maybe that's not what those feelings meant, then he was done. That was it for him. Wow. So.
Wow. And have you guys taken your names off the roll, or are your names still there?
We are still on the roll. So my parents are in our ward.
Oh.
Which is really interesting. They just bought a house about 2 miles down the road from us. So we're neighbors, and we still haven't talked to them about why we don't go to church anymore.
Huh.
It's really kind of weird.
Huh. Okay.
But it's an unspoken thing, right? Like, it's assumed that, I mean, you're inactive. That's how they would consider
it. Inactive.
If they don't know anything else. So, I mean, it's your family, so it's not my place to assume. But I mean, unless you say otherwise, I mean, you're sinning in some way, right? I mean, what is it that what's your poison? Is it the drink? Is it the coffee? What's keeping you away?
Straight up crack cocaine.
Yeah, none of this soft stuff. Yeah.
No.
Wow. So no letter, no coming out party, not party, but you know what I mean? Like,
it'd be a party
for
us.
I've kind of expected an intervention or something, you know, like, I don't know. It's just weird. We just don't talk about it, but I'm sure we will eventually. But that's one reason that we haven't had our names removed yet, is just not ready to cause that kind of stir.
Yeah.
Sure.
In the family. But I'm the oldest of 6 kids, and 4 of us have now left the church. There's only 2 that are still in.
Wow.
So, and I was the 4th. The other 3 had been gone for years before me. So
what's the order? Like, where were they in the lineup of how old they were in the 6 kids and when they left? It's a random thing that I track.
So I'm the 1st kid. My sister was the 1st to leave. She's number 2 in the family, and she left right after high school. Okay. My parents made her go to church while she was living at home, and once she went to college, she never went again. And my brother, that's just younger than her, same thing. He left right after high school as well.
Okay.
And then my other sister, who has left, went to BYU and then left right after graduating. And she's number 4 in the family. So the 2 youngest are the ones who are still in.
Okay.
Including your brother, your brother who's gay still goes?
No. He was the 2nd one to leave.
Okay, okay.
He left right after high school too. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
And how are your parents with that? With your brother?
They're good. You know, it was really hard. Oh, with my brother?
Mm-hmm.
They're really, really good with it, actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah. Yeah, so my brother got married a couple years ago, and our whole family was at the wedding. It was beautiful. It was on a rooftop in Manhattan at sunset. And I was just so proud of my parents for being there. You know, they lit the unity candle, and it was beautiful. They've been great. They've been great about it. So
nice. Hey, we're getting some static. Are you guys hearing that?
I'm hearing it.
No, I'm not.
Oh,
is it coming from me?
Yeah, I think so. Because we only hear it when you talk, and then I guess you're not hearing it.
How about now?
Still there.
Still hearing it?
Mm-hmm.
Should I kick you off and re-add you?
Yeah, let's try that.
Chelsea. Oh, she's a robot, so yeah.
No, that's pretty good, actually. That's like our first technical difficulty. You have to cut out the parts where I don't sound good, you know, as usual, Tom. Like you said.
My
Bob. The first 15 minutes when I'm warming up and saying random bullshit.
Okay, is that better?
Oh, yeah, that's good.
It is way better.
Okay, good.
Nice.
Okay, so I guess this is a good time to wrap it up, but I guess Bob's probably been dying. Like, did you guys take his Bob Mormon cred scale, and where'd you guys score?
Oh, no.
I did take it, and in fact, I went back and looked at it when I knew that I was coming on, because I was like, oh, they're going to ask me about Bob's cred scale.
Jeez. It wasn't me, okay? I wasn't thinking about it.
You were thinking it, dude. You were texting me, like, ask him about the cred scale. I don't want to be so weird about it.
Tom's inventing this backstory to make me look like a total douchebag.
All right, I made that up. But
that was nice. But now that we're on the topic, so how did you do?
I was an 80.
Nice.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, I think the only one I was missing was my parents were converts, so I don't have a long line of Mormon ancestry.
We can overlook that. That's okay. Yes. What about you, Jamie?
You know what? My husband's gonna kill me. Well, I thought about it, but it's my husband this morning was like, you should go take that. You should see what you score as. And I just, you know, the sun was out. I wanted to lay out.
Other priorities.
I didn't care enough. Yeah.
I got a beautiful color today. So, I would not score near as high as Chelsea. So I'm going to guess 25.
Wow. So what transgressions in your life are pulling down the score?
Yeah.
Jiminy Christmas, how much sex did you have as a teenager?
A lot.
That must be it, right?
No. That's the only thing, right? you know, like my bishop wouldn't sign my paper so I could go to Rick's because I worked on Sundays.
Oh, that is a bull crap.
Yeah, I did get released from a Maya Maid presidency calling when I was a Maya Maid. I was just a bad example, apparently. And then my husband and I, we lived together before we were married. I mean, you name it.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I
guess.
Well, you sound pretty credible. So if you just want to, fill out the paperwork, I'll see about boosting your score on the side.
Ooh,
thank you. Oh, nice. Yeah. Nice.
That's good. Bob will cheat you in. That's great.
It's a workaround, of course.
Thank you. Okay. Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Hi, my name's Bob, and I live in West Jordan, Utah. I like to listen to Infants on Thrones as I take long walks around my neighborhood. You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com. And if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
No more lies. No more lies.
Great. So I think we got it. We're good. Tom, did you have anything else?
Besides, like, after the scenes discussion, like, so tell us the real dirt on this.
Yeah. say something dirty. That's like what Infants on Thrones does. Is it's like there's a normal conversation, then there's this music that fades out, and all of a sudden it's like my dick, blah blah blah, and it's like what? Where did that come from?
So that's
my
the
dick,
formula.
Blah blah blah.
Yeah,
that's the formula. Okay.
Like every third episode, Tom has like an out of context dick comment after the closing music.
We're gonna copy that. We're gonna copy that at Debris Society.
Okay.
Copy that formula.
You're welcome to. It works wonders, apparently. I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird because when we use a different measuring tape, there's always an added inch or whatever.
See, there it is, right there. It just like sliced that in for no reason whatsoever.
And then I bring a dick into it every time.
Yeah.
Too many dicks on the dance floor.
Too many dicks.
Too many dicks.
Going to
do love Infants on Thrones, but want to hear from more women?
Feeling like a vegetarian at a sausage fest?
You ready to branch out from this brodeo?
Come check out the Debrief Society podcast,
where the estrogen flows freely and there's girl talk to spare. There's also fewer references to balls.
Some references, sure, but fewer.
Find us on iTunes or at debriefsocietypodcast.com.
Too many men, too many boys, too many misters, not enough sisters, too much time on too many hands, not enough ladies, too many men, not enough ladies, too many men, not enough ladies, too many men, too many men, too many men.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.